This winter, Sourcebooks has begun publishing a new series with the stated intent of bringing the Shakespeare page to life. Each paperback comes with an accompanying hour-long CD that contains scenes from various historic productions featuring the likes of Paul Robeson, Kenneth Branagh, and Kate Beckinsale. Contributors include some of the most renowned experts on Shakespeare, like David Bevington, whose name will be quite familiar to those who've majored in English Lit, and Andrew Wade, a voice coach who worked for 16 years with the Royal Shakespeare Company and served as verse consultant for the movie Shakespeare in Love. And Mr. Wade joins me now. Hello.
Hello.
So what's the first thing you do when you begin to work on it with an actor on one of Shakespeare's plays? How is there something that you try to get them their mindset going into?
I think for me that the most important starting point is how do we discover meaning by speaking out aloud? I know for myself that I came to Shakespeare on the page in school, and I was being asked to write answers about him to questions. And it wasn't until I heard him in the theatre, and then the next day to actually have those words in my mouth and in my body, that I really began to really understand what he was about.
Well, how would you coach me to say, for example, a line from Hamlet's soliloquy? Just say it straight, to be or not to be? That is the question?
Well, we've all got to find our own connection to those words. So, absolutely. So, my job as a voice coach is, I don't think, to impose a set way of speaking those lines. It's really to work within the parameters of the production and to really open out that language. So the starting point would be you speaking those words in a rehearsal situation, and then asking you what you're trying to do with those words. But just to actually give yourself permission to hear the possibility of the word. So a word, for example, that only has two letters, like if you just say that out aloud.
If.
And now say it, but give yourself a chance to listen to the implication of that word when you say it.
Mm-hmm. If. You mean something like that, where I can think about all the different kinds of ifs there are?
Well, that's possible. Well, just
because a lot of actors have told me that the best way to do Shakespeare is to trust Shakespeare and just say the lines, and he will provide all the guidance just through the rhythms of the words.
Well, absolutely. But actually what we mean by trusting the words, I think it's quite a complicated one. So just to hear the words out aloud, then in a way one is beginning to hear those possibilities. So I only take the word if because I think it's quite interesting that it's a word, obviously, that only has two letters. And it seems to me that increasingly today we are speaking language by the amount of letters on the page and not by their sound. So to give oneself a chance just to hear the implication of those sounds, if, it often opens up the fact that language, of course, is about possibilities, not just about definitive dictionary definitions.
We have an excerpt of you coaching Bill McCallum at the Guthrie a few years back. Maybe we should listen to that.
Do it three ways for me.
Okay.
Do the line before.
Mm-hmm.
And let me just invite you to try it that when you come to as asses are, that you pause before you say as asses are.
Great.
Try that.
The Moor is of a free and open nature that thinks men honest that but seem to be so, and will as tenderly be led by the nose as asses are.
Great. Same thing, but now give yourself a space after are and go on.
Okay.
So that actually it becomes pointed in that way.
The Moor is of a free and open nature that thinks men honest that but seem to be so, and will as tenderly be led by the nose as asses are. I haft.
Great. And now give yourself more room, time, within the words as asses are.
Great.
Spread them.
The Moor is of a free and open nature that thinks men honest that but seem to be so, and will as tenderly be led by the nose as asses are.
And which did he finally decide on using?
I'm not sure you end end up just saying one particular way. That I think the job of the voice coach is to give possibilities, which is why I think the word if is interesting. So in a sense, it's to open his imagination and confidence to hearing those possibilities, and that's going to shift, really.
Do you think it's different today than it was in Shakespeare's day when some of the language was less archaic?
It's an easy answer, isn't it? Because we can't prove it. But, you know, of course it was very different, because the big difference is that the listener would be different. The society produced a very different reference point. I mean, I'm working on Hamlet at the moment at the Guthrie, and one is reminded constantly that Hamlet says, "Will my father hear the play?" You and I, obviously in colloquial English, say, "I'm going to see a play." And for me, that begins to set up a whole area of where the voice coach can perhaps have a contribution towards the production itself. Because, you know, for me, how do we get an audience today to be excited by the language? To see with their ears and not just with their eyes. And that's for me why these recordings and these books are so important, because I think I was excited by listening, by hearing radio, and not just by the visual stimulation and the reassurance.
Because actors can get a lot across just through the way they move their bodies, and sometimes the words get lost as a result. An awful lot of actors just rush through the Shakespearean lines as though they were some kind of torture that had to be ended as quickly as possible.
We seem to have an uncomfortable relationship to language, don't we? We often seem to mistrust it, apologize for it, whereas Shakespeare seems to remind me all the time that it's almost speaking as an oath, that you stand by what you say. And what is it when you really stand by what you say rather than ums and ahs and apologize for it?
You emphasize the actor's personal relationship with the text. How do you balance that with a director's vision for a performance? Do you ever get in each other's ways?
No, interesting point. I mean, for me, again, as a voice coach, that my job is not, that's why it's not there to impose a viewpoint. It's really to work within the vision of that director and with those actors. I obviously have a viewpoint and a taste, like we all do, of how we want something to sound, which I think is interesting. But I think it's my job, like, well, we're just hearing a bit of Bill working. It's my job to open those possibilities up, not to say, this is how it should be.
Although in some cases, I'm sure you're working in rather strange versions of the play, things that are set in places that Shakespeare never could have imagined, with costumes that Shakespeare probably would have been horrified by.
Absolutely. But again, I just have to gently remind myself that the language is the leading costume, is the leading character. And how in any production do we just gently keep the language center stage, really?
In her book, Reading Lolita in Tehran, Azar Nafisi talks about how the meaning of Nabokov's work and other Western texts can change when read by people from a different culture. You've worked as a voice coach in South Africa, in India, Japan, Northern Ireland, Poland, Singapore, and a number of other places. Does the meaning of Shakespeare's plays change in all those locations? And, for example, when Othello was performed in apartheid South Africa?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, often one gets asked, why are there so many productions of Hamlet this year, for example, or Macbeth or whatever? And I suppose it's fairly obvious, but for whatever reason, that play is speaking to that director and that company because of what's happening at this point in the society. And without question, in different cultures, then Shakespeare speaks in a very different way. You mentioned about working in other countries. I was working on a production of Midsummer's Dream in Colombia, South America, last year. And that was very interesting because I was not aware of the political status of the Spanish language to many Colombians till I went there. But the fact that they feel that, of course, is an imposition of a language, and they're not quite sure what language absolutely expresses them with their African roots and their Indian roots, but somehow Spanish isn't quite right. And in a curious way, I was expecting there to be a resistance to working on Shakespeare in the right healthy way, that it's not ours, why should we do it anymore? But in a curious way, they were more able to relate to it because of this other distance in relationship to language. So I think that's very, very interesting as well. And the whole class system there, they do a lot of Oscar Wilde, ironically, in Colombia. And you go, oh, my God, how embarrassing. Why? You know, please, you must have shows that reflect you. But with their class system, they hear that in perhaps a more astute way than I do.
And then we understand it in similar ways, because I saw A Midsummer Night's Dream done in the Amazon, a Brazilian version of it,
great,
so to speak.
Yes.
And it took on a whole new meaning,
yes,
even though it was just pure Shakespeare. In the Othello source book, there's an essay about how early 19th century productions of the play were performed in exaggerated African-American dialect and blackface. How did things like historical context and cultural location and that sort affect the interpretation of a play? Obviously, Shakespeare was unaware that sort of thing ever would have happened.
Absolutely. I mean, just on the whole thorny issue of accent, dialect, whatever we're going to refer to it as, that it seems to me that Shakespeare is rather uninvolved in it, doesn't really care, doesn't really matter. And I think it's often the relative importance that we put on it. So I think from the point you're making, therefore, it speaks in a very particular way if you place it somewhere with a particular sound.
Many American actors feel the necessity to perform with a British accent, and yet there are some people who feel that the sound of Shakespearean English was a lot closer to American English.
Well,
especially Southern American.
I think it's really, really important that good speaking should not ever be about a particular accent. I don't think being audible rests in any particular accent. So that's really important for me as a voice coach to politically work from. And I know that when I've been in Virginia, when I hear local actors working in Shakespeare, it seems to me their rhythms are perfect for Shakespeare. Newfoundland, I think that is absolutely fantastic. And, of course, many settlers settle there, so it's perhaps not too surprising. I think the American connection to sound and vowel, for me, is closer than for the English person, interestingly enough. Just how so many American dialects seem to be much more based on vowels, whereas British dialects are much more based on pitch. And when you really begin to open out the vowels in Shakespeare, it seems to me that I'm getting to the heart of something that is beyond an intellectual understanding of language. It's a physical thing.
My guest is Andrew Wade, who was for 16 years the voice coach at the Royal Shakespeare Company. Now he works at many other places as well, and he is one of the contributors to a new series from Sourcebook called the Sourcebook's Shakespeare, the first two volumes, Romeo and Juliet and Othello. And the books come with CDs, which allow us to hear different interpretations. And I want to play a little bit from Paul Robeson's performance of Othello in 1944.
Most potent, grave, and reverend signors, my very noble and approved good masters, that I have ta'en away this old man's daughter, it is most true. True, I have married her. The very head and front of my offending hath this extent, no more. Rude am I in my speech, and little blessed with the soft phrase of peace, for since these arms of mine had 7 years' pith, till now some 9 moons wasted, they have used their dearest action, the tented field, and little of this great world can I speak, more than pertains to feats of broil and battle. And therefore little shall I grace my cause in speaking for myself. Yet by your gracious patience, I will a round, unvarnished tale deliver of my whole course of love. What drugs, what charms, what conjuration, and what mighty magic! For such proceeding I am charged withal. I won his daughter.
Could you have given him any decent advice?
The advice would be that was wonderful, wasn't it? Oh, it's great.
But also he has that incredible voice, and not every actor has a voice that is so beautiful.
No, that is true, isn't it?
Well, does that affect the way someone might deliver a line?
You know, I feel that I must work from the premise that we can all do this. How we all relate to it in different degrees, of course, is going to vary a lot. So some people are blessed with an intuitive response to language in a way that surprises my ears all the time and have qualities in their voice which are just wonderful. Some people just have something special, don't they? Elvis did. I don't know how you put your finger on it, but he had something there, the X factor in the sound. But again, it's how do we keep people to be being excited by the word and not either just the sound of it in isolation or just some definitive meaning. I think it's very fascinating for us today to be treading that path.
Well, you've written in an essay in these books about how to keep Shakespeare practical.
Yeah.
What do you mean by practical?
Well, practical, I mean in the sense of speaking out aloud rather than always just seeing meaning as something locked in a dictionary. The fact that meaning is something that has possibilities, that word we keep coming back to this afternoon, really, when I speak something. So how something can change when I speak it, rather than that when I go to say something now, I've worked it out in a curious way, like our conversation. We have an agenda, we have a form, but exactly how this form is going to be filled in this half an hour is open to improvisation. And it seems to me I've got to remind myself that this text on the page is really a code for orality. It is not something fixed with its own sound, and yet I can give it sound with my voice, back to the Robeson, and with my imagination, and with my taste.
A caller who has worked as an NYU acting teacher wants to know about how the Stanislavski method might be applied or whether it should even be applied.
Well, interesting point. We can't deny where we are at today, and we are post-Freud, so the psychology comes into play when we hear Shakespeare. It seems to me that you are, in a Stanislavskian term, you are pursuing an action when you speak Shakespeare. It's just that thought, motive, and action are through those words. They're not around the words or underneath the words in a way that we might refer to other language and other texts being. So we can only be who we are, and we are all part of this tradition. But yes, it's through the word. How do we keep getting it through the language and not around the language?
You once worked with an actor who wrote soap operas who said your coaching changed the way he wrote. Why do you think that was?
Bit of a big claim, isn't it? It was at the end of a week's rehearsal on Macbeth in Vancouver, and I was just asked to take the first week of rehearsal to open up the form. How do we relate to form in Macbeth as a company? And yes, he said to me at the end of the week that he also wrote soap operas. And I think really what had happened was that he was reminded, I don't mean I taught him it, but I was he was reminded how everything has to be in a shape. And that so often the shape is half the meaning. Was it the poet Louis MacNeice who said that shape is half the meaning? But it's absolutely that point. We're looking at a recording section this morning at the opening of Midsummer Night's Dream, and just how things come in threes, and each individual part of that three means something, but the music of the three together adds up to something even more. And it's how do I relate to that other in language? Apparently that rule of three, as we call it, is in every language in the world, which I find fascinating.
Is Midsummer Night's Dream one of the upcoming books?
It is. Absolutely.
How did you wind up with Othello and Romeo and Juliet as the first two?
I don't know how they start. I dare say that Romeo and Juliet is an extremely popular text. It's used an awful lot in schools, and that's really, really important, I think, with Romeo and Juliet to again, excite through the ears so that we demystify. I mean, it seems to me, that particularly in America, that a publication like this is so important when we say very easily that it's important for an audience member to witness it in a theatre, and how hard that is today with distances and with how many productions there are. So to be able to, first of all, hear something and then go back to the text and refer to it and discover it as a performance text on the page, I think is really, really important.
And it was important to include these CDs. We have another excerpt from one of the CDs with these books. This one of you working with the young actors from the Guthrie Experience Actors in Training Program.
Households is, it seems like a large word.
It is a
large
word.
Kind of a mouthful.
And what does that tell you about its meaning? Does it? Anything?
Maybe they are large houses, you know.
But it's very full, isn't it? It's full in the mouth.
Yes, it is.
Now say it and give yourself permission to listen to yourself, listen to the thoughts as you say them out aloud.
In fair Verona, where we lay our scene.
Does that change it?
Yeah, at least for me. If you visualize what you're saying, the meaning changes.
Right.
You hear, I guess, what I call the train, the sort of driving force of the line.
But I was also thinking on your point that actually the word break actually breaks the iambic pentameter.
From ancient grudge, break to new mutiny.
And what does repetition imply to you as an actor? Is it important to notice?
It's important. Sometimes, in this case, it makes it... There's a contradiction, an irony, that civil could be related to unclean and blood.
Right.
Where civil blood makes civil hands unclean.
That helps me as a listener quite a lot.
Do you think of yourself as a teacher first?
Ooh.
Because you're also an actor as much as you're someone who's teaching people to act. I don't know whether you've performed any of these plays.
No, I haven't. No, I don't see myself as an actor nor a director. And I think certainly in England, that's been very important for me because voice coaches are relatively new inventions in theatre, as I get reminded of very often. And I think it's very important that I'm not seen to be, as you pointed out earlier, treading on the director's toes in any way. I'm there to be part of that team. So, I mean, I think teaching, yes, in that broader sense that actually by opening ourselves to experience and gaining more experience that we learn in that way.
I've always thought of voice coaches as the people who help Americans speak with a good British accent and vice versa.
That is certainly not what I'm interested in doing. Yeah, I'm not here to colonize the English language again. Yeah. No, I think it's actually very interesting to be working so much in America. I'm very grateful for this opportunity because it seems to me there is an awful lot of opportunity in America to be doing Shakespeare at the moment. It's incredibly popular. Some of the summer seasons where it's being done. And I think that there is an appetite now to absolutely work within the form and find the way for it to speak to a contemporary American audience. I think it's very exciting.
And we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of Shakespeare in the Park here in New York City. In fact, there's an event tonight to do that. My great thanks to you, Andrew Wade, the voice coach, now working a lot at the Guthrie with the Royal Shakespeare Company for 16 years. There is a series of books being put out by Source Books of Shakespeare's plays with lots of pictures and accompanying CDs. Othello and Romeo and Juliet are the first two. My great thanks to you, Mr. Wade, for being our guest today. It's been a lot of fun talking about it. Now I'm going to have to go back and try to say some of these lines.
Thank you very much.